Chapter 1. Sunda Strait, Sumatra. The Present Day. Sam Fargo eased back on the throttle, taking the engine to idle. The speedboat slowed, gliding to a stop in the water. He shut off the engines and the craft began rocking gently from side to side. A quarter mile off the bow, their destination rose from the water, a thickly forested island whose interior was dominated by sharp peaks, plummeting valleys, and thick rainforest. Below these, a shoreline pockmarked with hundreds of pocket coves and narrow inlets. In the speedboat's aft seat, Remy Fargo looked up from her book, a little escapist reading entitled The Aztec Codices, An Oral History of Conquest and Genocide, pushed her sunglasses onto her forehead and gazed at her husband. Trouble? He turned to her and gave her an admiring stare. Just enjoying the scenic view. Then Sam gave an exaggerated wiggle of his eyebrows. Remy smiled. A smooth talker. She closed the book and placed it on the seat beside her. But Magnum P.I. you're not. Sam nodded at the book. How is it? Slow reading. But the Aztecs were fascinating people. More than anyone ever imagined. How long until you're finished with that one? It's next on my reading list. Tomorrow or the next day. As of late, each of them had been saddled with a daunting amount of homework, and the island to which they were headed was largely the cause. In any other circumstances, the speck of land between Sumatra and Java might be a tropical getaway, but it had in the last few months been turned into a dig site, crawling with archaeologists, historians, anthropologists, and of course a plethora of Indonesian government officials. Like all of them, each time Sam and Remy visited the island, they had to negotiate the treehouse-like rope city the engineers had strung above the site, lest the ground collapse below the feet of the people trying to preserve the find. What Sam and Remy had discovered on Pulau Lagundi was helping to rewrite Aztec and U.S. Civil War history, and as the directors of not only this project but also two others, they had to stay current on the mountain of data coming in. It was for them a labor of love. While their passion was treasure hunting, a decidedly hands-on, field-intensive avocation based as much on instinct as it was on research, each of them had come to it from a scientific background. Sam, a Caltech-educated engineer, Remy, an anthropology and history major from Boston College. Sam had fallen fairly close to the familial tree. His father, now passed away, had been one of the lead engineers on NASA's space programs, while his mother Eunice, now 71, lived in Key West, the sole proprietor, captain, and chief bottle washer of a snorkeling and deep-sea fishing boat. Remy's mother and father, a custom home builder and a pediatrician author, respectively, were both retired and living the good life in Maine, raising llamas. Sam and Remy had met in Hermosa Beach at a jazz bar called The Lighthouse. On a whim, Sam had stopped in for a cold beer, and he found Remy and some colleagues letting off steam after spending the past few weeks hunting for a sunken galleon off Abalone Cove. Neither of them were starry-eyed enough to remember their first meeting as instant love, but the spark was undeniable. Talking and laughing over drinks, they closed down the lighthouse without noticing the hours slipping by. 6 months later, they were married there in a small ceremony. With Remy's encouragement, Sam had been pursuing an idea he'd been tinkering with, an argon laser scanner designed to detect and identify alloys at a distance, through soil and water alike. Treasure hunters, universities, corporations, mining outfits, and the Department of Defense came begging for licenses, checkbooks open, and within a couple years, Fargo Group Limited was turning a seven-figure profit. 4 years later, they accepted a buyout offer that left them undeniably wealthy, set for the rest of their lives. Instead of sitting back, however, they took a month-long vacation, then established the Fargo Foundation, and set out on their first joint treasure hunt. The wealth recovered went to a long list of charities. Now the Fargos stared in silence at the island before them. Remy murmured, "Still a little hard to fathom, isn't it?" "Indeed it is," Sam agreed. No amount of education or experience could have prepared them for what they'd found on Pulau Lagundi. The chance discovery of a ship's bell off Zanzibar had mushroomed into discoveries that would occupy the attention of generations of archaeologists, historians, and anthropologists. Sam was shaken from his reverie by the double whoop of a marine horn. He turned to port. Half a mile away, a 36-foot Sumatran Harbor Patrol boat was headed directly for them. "Sam, did you forget to pay for gas back at the rental place?" Remy asked Riley.
"No. Use the counterfeit rupiah I had lying around."
"That might be it." They watched as the boat closed the gap to a quarter mile, where it turned first to starboard, then to port in a crescent turn that brought it alongside them 100 feet away. Over a loudspeaker, an Indonesian-accented voice said in English, "Ahoy! Are you Sam and Remy Fargo?" Sam raised his arm in the affirmative. "Stand by, please. We have a passenger for you." Sam and Remy exchanged puzzled glances. They were expecting no one. The harbor patrol boat circled them once, closing the distance, until they were 3 feet off the port beam. The engine slowed to idle, then went silent.
"At least they look friendly," Sam muttered to his wife.
The last time they'd been approached by a foreign naval vessel had been in Zanzibar. There it had been a patrol boat equipped with 12.7-millimeter cannons and crewed by angry-looking sailors bearing AK-47s. "So far," Remy replied. On the boat's afterdeck, standing between two blue-uniformed police officers, was a petite Asian woman in her mid-40s with a lean, angular face and a hairdo that bordered on being a crew cut.
"Permission to come aboard?" the woman asked. Her English was almost flawless, with only the barest trace of an accent.
Sam shrugged.
"Permission granted."
The two policemen stepped forward as though preparing to help her cross the gap, but she ignored them, taking a single fluid stride that vaulted her off the gunwale and onto the Fargo's afterdeck.
She landed softly, cat-like. She turned to face Sam and Remy, who was now standing at her husband's side. The woman stared at them a moment with a pair of impassive black eyes, then handed them a business card. It said simply, "Jilan Su."
"What can we do for you, Miss Su?" asked Remy.
"My employer, Charles King, requests the pleasure of your company."
"Our apologies, but we're not familiar with Mr. King."
"He is waiting for you aboard his private aircraft at the private charter terminal outside Palembang. He wishes to speak with you."
While Jilan Su's English was technically flawless, there was a disconcerting stiffness to it, as though she were an automaton.
"That part we understand," Sam said. He handed the card back to her. "Who is Charles King, and why does he want to see us?"
"Mr. King has authorized me to tell you it concerns an acquaintance of yours, Mr. Frank Alton."
This got Sam's and Remy's attention. Alton was not just an acquaintance, but rather a close, long-time friend, a former San Diego police officer turned private detective who Sam met in judo class. Sam, Remy, Frank, and his wife Judy had a standing monthly dinner date.
"What about him?" Sam asked.
"Mr. King wishes to speak to you directly regarding Mr. Alton."
"You're being very secretive, Ms. Hu," Remy said.
"Care to tell us why?"
"Mr. King wishes to speak with us directly," Remy finished.
"Yes, that is right."
Sam checked his watch. "Please tell Mr. King we will meet him at 7 o'clock.
"That is 4 hours from now," said Jilan.
"Mr. King
is going to have to wait," Sam finished. "We have business we need to attend to."
Jilan Su's stoic expression flashed to anger, but the look was gone almost as soon as it appeared. She simply nodded and said, "7 o'clock. Please be on time." Without another word, she turned and leaped gazelle-like off the deck to the harbor patrol boat's gunwale. She pushed past the policeman and disappeared into the cabin. One of the policemen tipped his cap to them. 10 seconds later, the engines growled to life, and the boat pulled away.
"Well, that was interesting," Sam said a few seconds later.
"She's a real charmer," Remy said. "Did you catch her choice of words?"
Sam nodded.
"Mr. King has authorized. If she understands the connotation, then we can assume Mr. King is going to be just as genial."
"Do you believe her?" About Frank? Judy would have called us if anything had happened. While their adventures often led them into dicey situations, their daily lives were fairly calm. Still, Jilan Su's unexpected visit and mysterious invitation had both their internal warning alarms going off. As unlikely as it seemed, the possibility of a trap was something they couldn't ignore. "Let's find out," Sam said. He knelt down by the driver's seat, retrieved his backpack from under the dashboard, and pulled out his satellite phone from one of the side pockets. He dialed, and a few seconds later, a female voice said, "Yes, Mr. Fargo." "Thought this was going to be the lucky call," Sam said. He had a running bet with Remy that someday he'd catch Selma Wondrash off guard, and she'd call either of them by the first name. "Not today, Mr. Fargo." Their chief researcher, logistical guru, and keeper of the inner sanctum, Selma was a former Hungarian citizen who, having lived in the United States for decades, still retained a trace of an accent, enough that it gave her voice a slight Zsa Zsa Gabor lilt. Selma had managed the Library of Congress's Special Collections Division until Sam and Remy lured her away with the promise of carte blanche and state-of-the-art resources. Aside from her hobby aquarium and a collection of tea that occupied an entire cabinet in the workroom, Selma's only passion was research. She was at her happiest when the Fargos gave her an ancient riddle to unravel. "Someday you'll call me Sam." "Not today." "What time is it there?"
"About 11.
Selma rarely went to bed before midnight and rarely slept past 4 or 5 in the morning. Despite this, she never sounded anything less than wide awake.
"What have you got for me?"
"A dead end, we're hoping," Sam replied, then recounted their visit from Jilan Su. "Charles King comes off like the Anointed One."
"I've heard of him. He's rich, with a capital R.
See if you can dig up any dirt about his personal life."
"Anything else?"
"Have you heard any news from the Altons?"
"No. Nothing," replied Selma.
"Call Judy and see if Frank's out of the country," Sam requested. "Look into it discreetly. If there is a problem, we don't want to alarm Judy."
"When do you meet King?" Selma asked.
"In 4 hours.
"Got it," Selma said with a laugh in her voice. "By then, I'll know his shirt size and his favorite flavor of ice cream."